Welcome back to the Bright Lights of Broadway. This is The Cosmic Curtain, the official podcast of the Cosmic Circus Broadway. I'm Brian Kitson, head writer over at the Cosmic Circus and Cosmic Circus Broadway. And joining me, as always, is my co-host and fellow backseat babe, RJ Miller-Zelenko. How's it going today?
Pretty swell. How about yourself, sir?
It's a Monday. We're living the life, beginning the week, as they would say.
Whatever that means.
Absolutely. It's a great day to be from the state of Michigan with the Tigers winning their games, as I've been told by RJ. So not only that, we're here to celebrate the second show of Broadway in Detroit, 2024-2025 season, which is Some Like It Hot. Real quick, spoiler warning, if you haven't seen Some Like It Hot and you haven't seen the movie from the 1940s or 50s, what are you doing here? Why are you here? I mean, obviously we want you to listen, but like, you know, don't get yourself spoiled. So then, jumping right in, this is a film, this is a musical that's adapted from a 1959 film starring Marilyn Monroe, Tony Curtis, and Jack Lemmon, which I'm sure we've heard of some of those names. Have you seen the show before?
I have not.
I did not either, which I had some people tell me that, like, you have to watch the movie, it's so good. And I don't think you needed to watch the movie before you saw the musical.
I mean, I would be curious to see what the differences are due to the time when it was created and now when it's been brought to the stage. But I don't think that there's anything particularly, nothing, even with Marilyn Monroe starring in it. Like, you can typically know what you're to expect with Marilyn. So, yeah.
I was informed by someone that was actually the film where she does the stepping over the grate
thing. Like, oh, yeah.
So, like, the fact that, like, that is the film, we all kind of know a scene from it, but, like, I couldn't tell you what this show was going to be about before we went and saw it. I had no idea. I went into it blind. No idea what the music was going to be, no idea about the story. But from what I understand, it's, like, that classic comedy that, like, people go to, and like, this is like quintessential Marilyn Monroe and Tony Curtis, and you know, there's the whole, you know, the laughing at the cross-dressing aspect of it. But I was really glad I kind of went into the show blindly. Do you feel like that like, did you like that you didn't know anything before seeing that?
Yes and no. One, for the purpose of not knowing like what alterations were made,
sure.
But also it did give me, like, it made me pay attention more. Like, I had to be paying attention to the characters and the plot a lot more closely than maybe shows I've seen a million times, because I know what to expect.
Sure.
And this one, I really had to follow what was going on,
mm-hmm.
which can sometimes make you lose out on some of the details because you're so focused on, let me just get the storyline down. But I was happy going in blind.
So I didn't know anything about the story much, but, you know, just to give people a little bit of background, this is a story of two men that witness a murder and they have to get away. So to get away quickly, they dress up as women and join a traveling band, and their goal is to make it to Mexico. And if they make it to Mexico, they'll be free and clear of the mafia, That is a mafia, right?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
But along the way, they get themselves into trouble, mostly with falling in love and finding identities, which those, some of those aspects are from the original story, but it seems like the identity of Daphne and Jerry, and the fact that we changed some of the ethnicities and backgrounds of some of the characters, is what really drove this story to be something different than what originally was. The first being that two of our main characters, the two of the three trios, are African American, and this does change the story quite a bit, because you get this, you know, we're during Prohibition times, and you know, we know what time was like back then. It wasn't great for anybody who was different. It wasn't great for anybody who was black. Like, there's this aspect of the story that is changed by changing the characters, specifically Sugar, Marilyn Monroe's character, who's played by Leandra Ellis-Gaston, who plays Sugar, And then Tavis Cordell, who plays Daphne/Jerry. Did you like that little update? Not knowing the original story, but like having this, it felt like it made the story almost more well-rounded to have this like other storyline about what life was like for somebody who wasn't a white man in America back during Prohibition times.
Yeah. I was curious immediately. I mean, because the opening number, it was something that was very clear to me. With it being about what it was about and in the time frame that it was, I was like, I wonder how many of these characters were originated by white people and have essentially been translated now to people of color. Or that could just be specific for this particular casting. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I think it was unique, and I liked feeling like they were drawing some attention to kind of that plot line. It wasn't entirely rom-com. There was still like a level of, like, I guess, historical essence, you could say, to it.
No, absolutely. And from what I understand, and this is having to talk to somebody who was like, gotta see the movie, that like everyone in the original film is white, which is makes a lot of sense when you understand that like when it was made there wasn't a lot of representation, unfortunately. Even so much so that Osgood's storyline of being code switching names while being like in Mexico and having the Spanish heritage, that was all for the show too. That was not in the movie, and that helps to further the code switching storyline of Daphne and Jerry. That works out really well, and I thought that was an interesting kind of component that they added in there. So, you know, adding these different, like I said, you know, backgrounds and ethnicities and you know, changing some of the characters, and like at the end of the day, Sugar is still Sugar, but she has now a more in-depth storyline because she's not just the pretty blonde girl. She's the girl who wants to see somebody on the screen who looks like her, which is something that I have heard. As a therapist, I've heard people say that they want to see somebody that looks like them. They want to have somebody in the pictures or singing songs or writing the stories that are representative of who they are. So to have that kind of modern story, but like also in this timeless tale, I think was a really cool transition that they added with having, by switching, you know, Sugar to being African-American.
Yeah, and the relatability, like you just mentioned, the representation, sadly, in a way to me, still rings true, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in the time frame that the show is, you know, taking place, in the time that it was originated, and then even today, some of these battles are still happening. And So I think even that makes it even more important that they did have it cast the way that they did. And yeah, it brings more depth. It brings more interest in regards to the characters. From what I was kind of getting from those around me that had seen the movie and had kind of grown up with the show, you know, Marilyn Monroe, it, of course, is the beautiful blonde, kind of like a sex symbol. And that is exactly who she was. Like, that is who she was as a person. That's who she was sold as in the movie. And so I would assume, without seeing the film, it's a big assumption, but I would assume that it would lack depth in regards to, you know, she as that character would already have that spotlight. And then, like you mentioned, this individual was really gearing towards that opportunity, and there was something to fight for. And I think we all love an underdog, right?
For sure.
So that just adds a whole other level to the plot line.
I mean, I think the first moment we meet Sugar, you know, in the bathroom, like she comes onto the train and she goes into the bathroom scene, and you got, as soon as I saw her and I said, well, this is not Marilyn's character. Not again, having not seen the film, and I feel like maybe this is like the big component we're missing here. But like when she walked in there, she was somebody who almost felt more like filled with like these hopes and dreams, and also not going to take no for an answer, and like was not going to just be the pretty face, but was going to be the person that set things into motion. Which if we look at like what a woman's role was back in the Prohibition times, that was not something that we saw. And we saw that not with just Sugar, but we saw that with Sweet Sue as well. Like, these are two people who are very much developed in ways that they, from what I understand, from what people told me, were not in the film, that they were just, they were playing second fiddle to, you know, Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, who were Joe and Jerry. And I feel like this story, this show was very much about, just as much about Sugar as it was about Joe and Jerry.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of had a railroad effect of parallel storylines that eventually cross, but you still get that individualistic frame of mind. You're still kind of rooting for both, even though they have different end games. And yeah, all around, because at the end of the show, really, you're like, you want the best for literally everyone, not just one side or the other.
Absolutely. I think that there was a moment where when Joe was pretending to be the producer or the writer, and like, I just wanted Sugar so bad to be in the movie that like, I was mad at him, which is rightfully so. He was pretending, but like, I was mad in the fact that like, she wanted this dream, and there was no way it was going to become a reality until the end, when she actually was just like, when Joe and her, like, let's go and make it a reality, let's go tell the story. And I was like, oh, this is, that was what I wanted. I wanted her to see herself and be herself on the screen so bad. I think like, I was more attached to Sugar than I was to some of the other storylines of this musical.
Yeah. Once again, I mean, like, we see, I think, men in general, like, once again, in the era of this film, like, it's a man's world type mantra, and they kind of, like, get what they want, and especially in rom-coms, like, it tends to be, like, he gets everything he wants and more, and that right. is the end. So it was right. nice to see, like, she has said she has wanted this from the beginning, and she gets to go where she wants to go without sacrificing who she is, or, you know, defying her character in any way. Like, it just stays very true to the end. Mm-hmm.
From what Wikipedia says, the movie ends with Sugar running and jumping onto the dock, and then just like confessing, like being okay with Joe and running off and wanting to just be with him because he's the only man that ever treated her well. So like, again, like that is, so that is very different than what the show that we got, and I'm almost glad that they didn't go that way. And I think that it would have alienated a lot of people of a modern audience if that was going to be the end.
Yes, and I think there's a lot of pieces in the show that were essentially maybe redone is not the right word, but were reconfigured to appeal to the current generation rather than keeping the older stuff in and having people feel like that didn't age well.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of those things that like the biggest change probably was making Daphne and Jerry non-binary. And while they never said those words because they didn't have that language or you know, or identifying as trans, again, they didn't say it because they didn't have that language. At least they didn't talk about that language back then. But like in the film, it actually ends, again, I know this because someone told me, it ends with Daphne like ripping off her wig and being like, I'm actually a man. And Osgood being like, well, nobody's perfect. And they laugh and they like, ride off into the sunset. But like it ends with him like revealing that he's a man, where in this story, we actually got the, I'm not a man. And like that was this like big like gender identity exploration. And I was not expecting that from the show at all. And I think that's probably one of the most positive ways we've seen it from like a Broadway story as of recently, of just being like finding your identity. And then like the way that Joe handles it too, of just being like, what do I call you? And then just like switching. And like, I think that there was this like this beautiful, like they took the time to get to know the person and the story. But I guess, what are your thoughts? Because I mean, do you think that they did pretty well with the trans storyline?
Yeah, I mean, so once, to reiterate everything you just said, totally shook when this plotline occurred, and was very... I at first I was terrified, because we see this storyline go south so many times, even when people are trying to be positive or write something well. But in this case, I thought it was pretty well done. I was pleasantly surprised. It is a very thin line to walk, because you're still trying to appease the older audience in regards to staying true to the story, but also take it from where we are today and where we are now, and using the language that we have now that they might have not had 50 years ago. So I think it translated very well. I absolutely loved, there was a line that, like you were kind of saying, where Joe is basically like, what do I call you? And as, I'll just out myself here, as a trans person, I related to that so much, because there are, I cannot say how many times people ask me, what do I call you? What name do I use? Throughout many stages of my transition. And typically, I said, actually very similar to the lines in the show, which was, ultimately, I do not care. You know, if you slip up and use my dead name, or if you use my name, as long as you're saying it with love and you're not coming from a place of, you know, essentially evil or trying to be mean, that's fine with me. I mean, of course, I would like to you to call me by my name, but essentially when I first came out, when I first transitioned, I knew, especially for family, I had lived under one name for almost, you know, 25 years. And so it's a hard thing for some people. I know, disclaimer, like, this is not everyone's experience, right? This is my own personal experience. But for the show to really kind of embrace that and basically say, like, it's less about the name and more about what you mean when you say the name. And then Joe basically saying, you know, okay. Like, it didn't have to be, they didn't make it some super elaborate scene. I think it was literally three lines for them just to be like, be kind, and him for to say, okay. And it's that simple. And that, especially in today's political and cultural climate, is really a massive takeaway, I think, and pretty cool that you can do that in front of an audience and kind of, it's always a toss-up. Everyone has their beliefs, but very cool to see that on stage, because once again, representation matters. And I myself had never seen or heard that being said live so blatantly or so clearly. I've obviously seen shows where the role was intentionally trans or non-binary and it was created that way, whereas this one kind of goes along that journey with the person. So that was a very long-winded way of saying I appreciated the way in which this show addressed the topic, because I'm sure that I wouldn't have loved the way that the film did it. So.
I was blown away by the line when Daphne says, you know, just do it with love. And I was just like, that is, I think that it says it all without saying much. It was like one line, and you were just like, from both sides, you know, as a cisgendered man, you know, you care about these people, and you just want to make sure that you do right by them. And then you do, you know, especially being a psychologist who specializes in trans issues, it's just like, you always want to make sure that you don't mess up. You know, it lets you know that, like, there's being seen and being validated is just as important as being right. I don't know. I think that's the right way to say that. It did cross my mind that I was worried about the, like you said, like, with some people, some of the older generation were going to go in there and they were going to, like, that was not what they expected. And I hope that they took away the right message from that. Not that someone, like, changed the story for the sake of being, like, changing the story, but like changing the story to explore an identity that was probably there in the original story, but there wasn't the that wasn't the moment that people were talking about it, and there wasn't anybody at that time that could look at that film and say, I'm being seen in that. And there, we can have this classic story, switch it to a modern generation and say, we see you, you're validated, and it's totally, this is probably something that would have happened to somebody who went through that journey and found themselves.
Yeah, and I can't speak for her, but I did bring my mother along on this to the show with us, and she had seen the movie. She grew up with it. She was born a few years after the movie came out, and so of course it was more so, I guess, my grandma's time. But she was familiar with it, and we actually had a 45-minute conversation around this topic on our drive home, because I was curious about how the movie ended and how it was perceived. And we did discuss that this was just something that may have always been, but the terminology and the safety around those identities didn't exist even as she was growing up, which was, you know, a couple decades after this show came out. And so, yeah, absolutely. Just as we know, our language and our how the world works and how our culture operates changes, I mean, literally daily, but especially sure. generationally. And so, yeah, I agree. I do hope that, you know, some people will feel very strongly one way or the other, but I do hope that it felt, I thought they did a good job at making it feel a tad more educational and not like we're shoving this down your throat.
Right.
They're just being like, it's simple. This is who I am, and I'm good with that. And I felt like it was, well, from what I heard, it seemed well received.
I would agree. That entire audience, they were, it sounded like they're eating it up. And people that I talked to after the fact, everyone has seemed to love it, which is really, I know that there was quite a few empty seats, and I hope that like word of mouth is strong for this one, for this reason specifically. And I also loved how subtle it was at first, because there was actually a moment in like the first act where Daphne, I noticed, was just like in the back of a scene and was just like touching her hair. And I was just like, are they going where I think they're going? And then, like, it started to go. And by the time we got to the scene in Mexico, I was like, oh, we're here. And, like, I was just like, and I think that, like, that also, like you said, it was educational without being, like, beating you over the head with it, because it was like, this is slowly dropping those little bits. And you're just getting a little bit more and a little bit more, because at the beginning, Jerry was actually very much against it. They were not going to dress up. They were not going to be a woman. And then, like, by the time they got into the train and they're in the bathroom, they're looking at themselves in the mirror and they're like doing different things, and they have a slightly different strut, and that strut got slightly more dynamic as the show went on. And I just thought, wow, it was almost magical to see, because we don't see this. I can't even think of a single Broadway show right now that does a trans storyline anywhere near this. I can't even think of one that actually does a trans storyline that's in the popular media right now, other than Anne Juliet.
Yeah. Yeah. And even that, I mean, that's the one I can think of as well. And even then, it, because of the way that it's built, it doesn't address anything. It just kind of, there's a song and you're kind of shooting in the dark. Mm-hmm. In regards to if people are understanding what is being laid down. Mm-hmm. Whereas this just says it out loud. Mm-hmm. Which
it's
is
not bashful.
Yeah.
And in fact, the difference between this and Anne Juliet is that when we saw Anne Juliet and May sings Not a Girl But Not Yet a Woman, people laughed. And there was, I did not notice a single moment where anybody laughed about the storyline. In the way that it wasn't supposed to be laughed at. There were scenes where, like, Daphne, like when she gets back from Mexico and she's getting all flustered and bashful, like, they want you to laugh, and like, that's really funny, because you're laughing with Daphne, you're not laughing at Daphne. But when we saw Anne Juliet, people were laughing at May, And I did notice, like, I didn't know if it was just different times, different periods, different people, but there was something different about how people responded to this one.
Yeah, I think the generation, maybe the younger generation who's never seen it before, they feel closer to the topic.
Mm-hmm.
But the older generation, I mean, people are smart, you know? Like, I think if they had seen the movie, they knew there was something. And there weren't words at that time, or to poke fun of it didn't quite feel right, which is, I think, what the original film, of course, does. To just kind of push it off, right? Like, here's this whole movie about cross-dressing, and here now it's the butt of the joke. But that doesn't feel too genuine to the character, and I think this felt genuine, which is why people accepted it more. And whether that's because we got to see the whole story, or because we do see, and I agree with you, there were definitely parts, basically from the moment that they put the dresses on, that you started to see, you know, even the selection of the name,
mm-hmm.
that was my first hint that I was like, oh, because she didn't pick a name that was in
close.
Line with
yeah.
her dead name. She just, like, this name just came and it felt right. Or however she said it.
Right.
And once again, as a trans person, like, people ask me about my name all the time, and I say it just is. It just came to me. It just felt right. So once again, I'm sure there was somebody in the writer's room that knew or had or listened to non-binary or trans experienced folks, because it felt very, very genuine.
And I wonder what came first, and it would be a great question to maybe one day ask the writer something. Like, did we write this character first, or did it become part of, like, as you brought in the actors, did this become more? Did you workshop it with the actors? Because being that this actor uses they, them pronouns, while it does not say what their identity is in the playbill, it does use they, them. Is that part of what is workshop? Because we know that this show went through workshop before we saw it, and it was on Broadway, and there was obviously workshops before Broadway. Like, was this a collaborative approach, or, like you said, did somebody sit down and be like, this is a story we can tell, and we need to tell it right?
And it was just, obviously, it was sold, I can't even say sold well, because it's just real lived experience probably for this person, right? And so, yeah, did it feel that way because this person has literally lived that experience? That's also a possibility.
Sure. It also made me think of something you said on Moulin Rouge, which you said about Anne Juliet as well. This is not a jukebox musical. And so when we're telling stories and we're singing these songs, it's not like a song that everybody recognizes that we're giggling at. This is actually like a song that was from either the original movie or was made for the show. And that, I feel, almost allowed the story to be more impactful. At least I hope that's part of what it was, because something you said about, like, you know, he's singing Rolling in the Deep in Moulin Rouge, and it's like supposed to be this, like, really, like, Roxanne, Rolling in the Deep, heartbreaking moment, and people are laughing because they know this. Or, like, the plastic bag, which there is a line in one of the songs for Some Like a Hot where she says, do you ever feel? Sugar says that. And I could not stop for, like, 5 minutes thinking of a plastic bag. And yeah. I almost wanted to punch you.
I thought it too, so it's fine.
Moving on then from this, how did you feel about the cross-dressing aspect of this story? Because I'm going to say that when I started watching this and I thought, ooh, yikes, what are we going to do here? You know, granted, again, old movie, we've seen this happen before. Mrs. Doubtfire does this, Bosom Buddies. I mean, it's been done from time to time again, but I was like, oh God, like, is this the story to do? And I think it was softened and made better because of what happened with Daphne and Jerry. But what are your thoughts on the cross-dressing aspect of Some Like It Hot?
Yeah. I mean, with this, I mean, the show is literally built around it.
And sure.
So, yes, it for all of the reasons that we just spoke on, it redeems itself.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to me why I've never seen this movie, because I would probably hate it for that reason.
Absolutely.
Because you know that at the end, The cross-dressing is the butt end of a joke. And yes, you can say that it's in the name of comedy. And it is true for the time in which it was created. It just, I don't think, for me, it doesn't age well. And so yes. No part of me would go, and that's probably why, no part of me would go and watch this film and be like, oh, that was cute. because it was created in a world where men, white men, were ruling the world, and it was fun and funny to knowingly pick at a group of people, which is essentially what you're doing, in the name of, once again, in the name of comedy, in the name of escaping.
Right, we would not have a movie made like this nowadays.
Right. Right. Or if we did, I don't think it would be very popular.
Right. I thought this when I saw Mrs. Doubtfire the musical, and I thought that, man, while Robin Williams does a great job in the role, this movie would not get made in 2024.
Yeah, and I know there was actually, I remember there being chatter around that show when it started touring, and honestly, I haven't even seen it yet. I also have not seen the movie. I know the premise, but for the same reasons, I really struggle with the idea of creating comedy based on, here's a good reason to laugh at someone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're creating this reason, even though it might be done very well, like you said. But I sure. remember there being talk about, you know, the non-binary and or transness and versus cross-dressing, and that's a whole other topic.
Different podcast.
Yeah, you could say the same thing about Hairspray.
Yes.
And I'm sure other handful of shows. So,
right. Especially because, you know, like Hairspray is based off of a drag individual that they made the character. I mean, so is Ursula. Like, it's interesting what they did back in the day compared to now. And I'm glad that they were able to transition the story from one of just being like men are dressing as women to make it a joke to it was actually very important. And I think that when you look at it too, again, haven't seen the movie, what I liked is that it also changed Joe. It changed Joe in the fact of when we first meet Joe, he is having sleeping with all the women, and he's just like a player, and he's, you know, he's going around, and then having, it kind of reminded me of Beyonce's If I Were a Boy, like, because he learned through like Sugar and the other people of the band, he became a better man for Sugar, which I thought was an interesting too, because there was also a growth there that is a little more subtle. You don't quite get it quite as much. But he does want to change for Sugar at the end, and he probably would not have done that if he didn't go on that journey as well.
Yeah, he definitely, if I could put it in modern terms, he feels like a bro at the beginning of the show.
100%.
And then towards the end, you know, that bedroom scene, and he's sitting in the chair, and they're having that conversation, and even the ending scene, you're like, oh, he feels more gentle. Mm-hmm. Not in a super feminized way, but just in a, like, I am now aware of the world around me kind yes. of way.
Switching gears a little bit, this show has very much the big band feel, which you don't always see in a show. It kind of reminded me of Guys and Dolls a little bit from Nicely Theater. Did you like that? Did you like the big band feel?
Yeah, I mean, the music nerd in me is always, yes. Definitely immediately knew that it was going to be something along those lines, even just by the opening number. And of course, even for the time, right? That was the music of the time, and that was happening. So yeah, love jazz, love big band music, and everything that comes with it.
Did it feel dated at all? With the music?
I mean, it felt exactly like the age that it should have been.
Okay.
Like, it felt like, how else to say old school musical theater? You know, the...
Sure.
You're going to get the big numbers that are super long with a whole lot of dancing and maybe a little less singing, or maybe the singing is less intense because the dancing is very intense. Big ensemble numbers, rather than just ballad after ballad after ballad. So, dated in the sense of, yes, it is very aware that it still was created many decades ago.
Going off what you just said, I think I might be in love with tap dancing in that I loved Funny Girl, which was very tap heavy, and this was even more tap heavy than that. And I was just so amazed because some of those ensemble members are pretty much tap dancing from the moment they get on stage until the show's over 2.5 hours later. And I was like, that takes stamina, that takes energy. Like, you're dancing from one end of the stage to the other, and some of them have like costume changes in the middle where they're switching out. I know I said to you during intermission, I was like, I'd hate to be the sound engineer that has to switch between the shoes of all the different players, because everybody tap dances at some point in the show. That was probably one of the most impressive aspects of Some Like a Hot for me.
Yeah. And I think it's what draws some folks to it. Because it's a very unique skill and it's not something that is typically written into shows nowadays. And right. So, yeah, if you want to see this art form, really the only way to see it is to either literally go to a tap show or maybe something like, I don't know, the Rockettes or something like that, mm-hmm. or go to these older musical theater pieces, because you know that that's what you're going to get. And yeah, I think it was the heaviest tap show I've seen in a minute.
I mean, shout out to Tip Tap Trouble, that last scene where they're just going through all the doors and they're running away. I was like, oh my gosh, what is going? It was absolutely just impressive from start to finish.
I cannot imagine rehearsals for that number. All I see is just like over, and I'm sure it was like literally days of rehearsing just that number, because it is absolutely insane. And if, you know, if you get off by one beat, I mean, I don't even know, you're sunk, because it is moving quickly and it's moving with essentially 20 to 25 people doing different actions in every single beat, every measure of that song.
I mean, some are coming in backwards, some are coming in forwards. The doors were spinning. You had to know which door to go in and out of to give you that Scooby-Doo effect. In my head, I was like, I would have missed my cue for the door probably the entire show. I'd be coming out the wrong door. But they were superb. And each one was in sync, even when they were doing it backwards. And I was just like, that had to take so much effort, so much time, so much energy. And I hope that they feel rewarded after they do that, because that was, I mean, that right there is a reason to go see the show.
Yeah, if I remember right, I think there was kind of an elongated applause after that number, which mm-hmm. rightfully so, because I'm also positive that they are all like dying, like huffing and puffing, because you can't not. I don't know how long that song was, but it was very long. And there were definitely, I mean, I think 2 to 3 costume changes occurring simultaneously and then cycling back through before the song was even over for, of course, you know, the comedic effect.
Absolutely. I mean, and when they mean 11 o'clock number, that 100% was just the right way to do it. It had to be at least 5 to 10 minutes long. I can't find the exact time because it's not even on the cast recording, because it's just all tapping. There's no singing, but mad props to everybody involved in that scene, because whew, I was tired just watching it. Who were the standout singers and performers for you? Was there anyone that just blew you away? I have one, and I think it might be the same as yours, but...
Oh, man.
You're not going to say Sugar?
I mean, I am. I am. There's no... I mean, they're all so good, right? Of course,
fantastic.
They're professionals. But yeah, her delivery was just spot on. And it felt effortless. And sometimes mm-hmm. Sometimes when you see a show, it feels exhausting. Like not in a, they must be exhausted. But like, as a vocalist, like I can hear them straining or I can hear them reaching or, whereas, like, when I listened to her, it was just, like, I didn't think about literally anything except the words that were coming out of her mouth, because it just was effortless. So, yeah.
Do you know what role she played before she went to the show? Because I'm writing the review right now, and I had looked it up, and I was shocked.
I mean, probably some powerhouse.
She played Anne Boleyn on Six on Broadway, and I was like, that fits.
Yeah, she's got pipes. She's got some pipes.
100% though, Sugar was fantastic, but I also have to say that Tavis Cordell, especially when they were singing the Knock Me Over Like a Feather, that was just, you could have knocked me over with a feather. And that last note that they hit was just like, I was like, damn. And they had a range where they could hit the low notes, they went to the high notes. Like, you don't usually see range like that in a show. Usually you kind of got your part and you stick with it, you know. You have your, what is it, your octave? Is that what it's called? Your range. But they went from, like, bottom to top and just everything in between. And I was shocked by that. That end of that song, I was like, yep, they're a star.
Yep. It's a demanding, once again, these older shows, like, they just have, they demand more, I think. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think between the two of them, they outshowed Joe quite a bit, because Joe was more of the comedic, you know, the comedy role. He was more of the tap dancer. You could tell he was a dancer. But not that he couldn't sing, but the other two were like...
Yeah, and that role is not like really built to showcase a voice, I don't think. It is exactly like you said. It's the comedic relief. It's the, you know, there was, yeah, maybe a little bit more dancing. With like even comedic dancing, because his facial expressions were always over the top. But yeah, vocally a very good singer, but just didn't need to be on the level that the others were.
Speaking of this being a heavy show up with heavy comedy, did you like the comedy? Because I know that sometimes, depending on what it is, comedy's not always your favorite. Specifically, like, I know you didn't care for Deadpool. This was no Deadpool kind of story. But there, it was heavy on the, like, getting you to laugh. Did you like that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think, more real-life humor, if I can say that. And just built on life experience. So, you know, jokes that feel a little bit more real and less kind of that they're grabbing at, you know, kind of a pun or two. But yeah, I mean, I know I laughed, so, and the audience, the reaction was overall very good. So.
You didn't just laugh. There were scenes that you were literally belly laughing, and I was just like, who is this man? He does not laugh at like that at show. So I knew it had to be good because you were literally like out of breath laughing at a few parts. And I was just like, oh. This is hitting his funny bone.
I mean, apparently that's where it is.
I don't, but it could have also been the environment. Like when you're with people and they're laughing, like I could hear your mom laugh. I could hear your sister laugh. The people behind us were having the best time of their lives. There was specifically a man behind me who would not like, he was living, he was thriving. That made me laugh more. And I feel like when you're in an environment, when people are laughing, you're more inclined to want to laugh and join along because of the psychological aspect of like nobody wants to be left out, but also because you're like, oh, this is funny. We're all laughing. With that joy, that environment of like shared joy is intoxicating. And so I felt that too, where I was like, I was laughing a lot more in the show than I thought I was going to. And I didn't know if I was like, is it because I'm actually finding this super funny, or is it because I'm finding it funny, but so is everybody else. So we're all joining in on this. And so, you know, chicken or the egg, but like I was impressed with the comedy of the show. Was there anybody that you felt was weak in the acting department, or do you feel like everyone did a pretty good job?
I wouldn't say weak per se. I mean, there are supporting roles that you don't really get to know or are not super familiar with, and it's easy to say that those feel like lesser, but really I just think it's because we see them literally less and we don't get to know them as much. But yeah,
kind of like Osgood.
All of them felt very strong.
Sure. I would say that like definitely what you said about like not knowing some of them more, like Osgood not coming into like the last scene of this act one, you at first you're just like, who the hell is this guy? And he did have a pretty juicy role as it went on, but it took a while to get like who is this stranger joining our story? I've just spent all this time with these three people. Why are you coming in and ruining it all, you know? Because you didn't have enough time with him, you know. But I think that the actor did a fantastic job, but that was good because he was exceptional in the end. But yeah, no, the whole cast was pretty fantastic. What about the costumes in the set? This was 100% a show trying to make you think it was the 1930s. The costumes seemed really impressive. They were very shiny. They were, you know, or like they, you know, they definitely played up Joe being older with some more of the older clothes, which I will say, I guess that's the one thing about the comedy of that one that like by the end of it, I was like, okay, we get it. He's old. And I think that what I was told is that in the original film, they kept playing it off that he was an ugly woman. And so you're ugly, you're ugly, you're ugly. And they changed it to you're old, you're old, you're old. So when I understood that, I was like, okay, I get it. Again, I think that maybe that one was beat over the head a little bit too much, but I understand. Like, I think that's better than trying to say he was an ugly woman. All the costumes seemed very impressive of building the story and the time. Did you like them?
Yeah, I would agree. The costumes were incredible. The set was exactly what I would expect it to be, because it's a dance and voice heavy show. Like, your focus is not particularly on the stage. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just there as props. It's there to be used by the actors and actresses, but not really vital to what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But it did the job. Like, there wasn't anywhere where I was like, that doesn't feel right. And everything felt seamless. Like, there weren't a lot of breaks in the scene where it was like, all right, what is going on?
Sure.
So, yeah.
I mean, yeah, they definitely left the floor quite open for the dancing. In fact, the only set piece that maybe got a little chuckle at was just because it looked a little funny was the boat. I think it was supposed to intentionally look funny. Like, you're on this yacht and it just kind of like, you can still see the scene behind it, you know, so I did chuckle a little bit at that one, but I loved the chandeliers that came down because like, that's sometimes what really gave the club its feel. Like, the background was very beautiful, but it was so set far back so that they could dance. But those chandeliers came down and you felt like, oh, we're in a jazz club. We're in the mix of it all. That felt cool.
Yeah. I will say my mom mentioned the lights that they dropped when they go to Mexico. And she said, what a cool way to just very simply, you know, they really didn't change the set at all aside from, you know, a couple chairs and the lights. But it gave you exactly what you wanted because, and that's just such a simple thing. Nothing crazy.
I was gonna say, I was also for some reason very impressed with the tables that they rolled in and out, and those people were just like pushing them with their legs, and they like zoomed across the stage, and I was like, that is such a cool effect because that's how you get somebody to and from. You build that scene of like having the tables of the jazz club. That was like a really cool, like, just the. It probably wasn't meant to be as cool as I thought it was, but I just thought like, wow, that is really, that's just really impressive. Loved it. All right, our favorite question. Does Some Like It Hot have rewatchability?
I would say yes.
Okay.
Because I would want to go back and see all the things that I missed with it being a show that I had zero information on to begin with. Now that I have an idea of what the show actually is, I would want to go back and see all the little things. Mm-hmm. And just entertainment value wise, of course, like we said this whole time, ton of music, ton of dancing, always something happening. The first act always feeling a tad longer than the second one, but the second one flew by. So I'd say yes. How about you?
I would agree. I think this has great rewatchability. Even when there was something that went wrong, and by I went wrong, I'm going to say that Daphne's hat fell off quite a few times, but they impressively picked it up. Like, it would be like a part of their dance. You wouldn't even realize it was gone. They'd pick it up, they'd move on, and I was just like, wow, this is so seamless. It's so beautiful. And the fact that the way that these people are dancing across the stage and the way that they're singing, it was beautiful. And so absolutely, we loved that. So yeah, a big thumbs up from me. And that is about all the time that we have. So thank you again for listening to another episode of The Cosmic Curtain, the official podcast of the Cosmic Circus Broadway. Don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe to us at Boxy Babes or at My Cosmic Circus. If you're interested in finding out, finding us outside of our box seats, please check us on our social media handles. Yes, we lost RJ, unfortunately. And that's okay. But you can find me at Kitson301. And you can find RJ on Instagram, journeys_through_the_pass_. And we would love to be able to continue the conversation. Of course, you can find all of our reviews and our work on The Cosmic Circus Broadway. And we look forward to their next curtain call. Take care, everybody.